If I may have your attention, we might as well start. We've got a lot of things to cover and some very interesting material. My name is Keith Frogley. I'll be your chair today. I'll also be giving a few comments. We're basically talking about a book that was been published recently by Margaret Batten, who is a professor at the University of Utah, dealing with ethics in the sanctuary. What we'll be talking about mainly this morning is the telling of confessions, which is the chapter one, which deals with confidentiality between religious organizations and their membership. We will have an overview of both the philosophical, which Margaret has given us very ably, and we have Father Busson from the Catholic Diocese who will speak as to the Catholic viewpoint. We have two lawyers, Gary Ferguson and Mike Homer, who will look at it from a legal aspect. And I will give some views on the Mormon relationships to confidentiality in the Mormon confession or bishop's interviews. And at the end of that time, Ms. Batten will respond. And then we will open it to questions and discussions from the floor. First of all, I'd like to introduce our panel. Our author, the most celebrated, Miss Batten, is a graduate of Bryn Mawr, and everything she's graduated in has been cum laude. She took her degree there, took a master's from the University of California, and a PhD in philosophy from the University of California, and is now teaching as a professor, full professor at the University of Utah. On my left is Father Busson, who is the vicar of the Salt Lake Diocese, which he comes from Ogden, took his theological training at the seminary in Denver, and is responsible mainly for most of the administrative organization of the Salt Lake Diocese. Then Miss Batten, and next to him is Gary Ferguson. Gary Ferguson is a partner in the litigation firm of Williams & Hunt. He's admitted to the California, Utah, and Wyoming bars. He's been practicing since 1976, and especially in defense. I've got that right, have I? This is... Oh, okay. I got it mixed up. Gary Ferguson's on the end. Mike Homer is the next. We'll go back to Mike Homer. sorry. Mike Homer is a partner in the law firm of Souter and Axland, Armstrong and Hanson, where he specializes in real property litigation. He was a member of the Ethics Advisory Committee of the Utah State Bar from 1983 to 1992. And then Gary Ferguson, on the end, is a partner in the litigation firm of Williams & Hunt. He's admitted to the bar in Utah, Wyoming, and Wyoming. He's been practicing since 76, specializing in defense, and was a member of the defense team in the John Singer wrongful death case. He also is an adjunct professor at the College of Law teaching trial advocacy. The basis of the chapter of our book deals with three examples concerning ethics in the sanctuary of religion. The first one being in Germany some years ago, there was a young boy who had committed a murder and had confessed it to his priest. The priest tried to have him confess to the authorities and to admit to his crime and to be forthcoming. But when the young man decided against that, the priest, keeping the his holy vows of confidentiality, did not bring his crime to light, and consequently, the young man committed three more murders of young boys with some rather violent accompanying tortures and so forth. That the ethics of that confession and the position of the Catholic Church will be talked by Father Busson this morning. There's a case of a young man in the Mormon faith who, upon finding that he had AIDS, went to his bishop and confessed to being a homosexual, and was given a bishop's court and was tried and was excommunicated. During that trial, he gave the names of his partners in his homosexual activities, and one of the young men, bishop, was contacted, and confidentiality of that relationship was compromised. We'll be talking about that this morning. And lastly, there was a young lady who was converted to the Church of Christ in Oklahoma, was given much help and refuge in the church, being a divorcee with a family, receiving an education and becoming prominent in the organization there, and then had an affair with the then mayor of the town, and it came to light of the church fathers. They went to her and asked her to confess before the body of the church. She said that she couldn't do that and withdrew her membership. There was a question of whether she could do that, and the fathers of the church read an indictment against her in before the body of the church, and she sued and won a case against the church and was given some redress, although our two lawyers will talk about the legal aspects of the case in Germany as it involves the First Amendment and some other things, and then we'll also talk about the legalities of the lawsuit in the Church of Christ. So we will begin there. Our order of response is such that I talked to Miss Batten, and she suggested that perhaps I present the Mormon overview point concerning confession and confidentiality. In her book, she talks about the Mormon bishop, when he finds fault or error in the membership, is responsible and has the obligation or the opportunity. I was interested in that she used that word as an opportunity to bring someone to a trial. It doesn't work that way. And if you'll bear with me, I have about 10 minutes of some overview concerning confession as such, and confidentiality, and how it might be approached from a Mormon bishop's point of view. In Chapter 1 of Ethics in the Sanctuary, the author presents to the reader three examples of the structured confessional process: one Catholic, one Mormon, and one from the Church of Christ. Reading the material, I came away with two basic impressions. First, the author was placing before the reader a deductive exculpation of the confessional process by tracing the directive roots of the confessional in all three of the noted religions. Basically, the Catholic transformation through the centuries, distilling into the present tightly structured ritual. The Mormon, emergent problems of an untrained clergy grappling with as yet a non-structured ritual. And the Church of Christ, Protestant, relying entirely upon the scriptures, even if anachronistic in its application. Second, the author was filing an indictment of inadequacy against the practicing authority of the noted three religions. She asserts that the established procedures of ethics and administration were less than properly operable. The subjective values or pragmatic response that are ever part of the confessional process were not discussed. Understandably, subjective expression and pragmatic example usually tend to be elusive and too broad for a comparative or deductive presentation. However, a comprehensive knowledge of the confessional is imperative to reach an understanding of why, when, who, and how. But also, we should be aware of a response towards behavioral improvement and lifestyle change sought by the three stated religions and encompassed within the confessional. For lives are not changed or rescued by directives. They are changed by the blending of trust and insight, confession and renewal, as practiced, even as practiced imperfectly. In his book, The Life of Christ, F.W. Farrar, who was Queen Victoria's chaplain, makes two or three observations concerning the blessings of knowledge. He states that man continues to ignore the external evidences of faith, and the skeptic is ever more eager to embrace denial, and that it is ever more important to embrace the truths that affect our hearts and minds rather than just to accept deductive reasoning. Every personal interchange or friendship that we have responds to those truths. We have all suffered greatly from ignorance. Ignorance and insufficient knowledge or insight into another's systems or beliefs. And we never can exist comfortably accepted if, when the occasion shall require, we cannot give an intelligent reason of the hoped-for godly propitiation that is in each of us. The magnitude of surrounding endless creation in which we are all involved demands it. Each of us continues to mine the intellect, searching for the glitters of truth and the base metal absolutes that we may be sustained in our religious beliefs. Let's look to the confessional essentially. Francis Bacon, who was the doubter's Shakespeare, said, "No recipe openeth the heart, but a true friend to whom you may impart griefs, joys, fears, hopes, suspicions, counsels, and whatsoever lieth upon the heart to oppress." With all the shadow and darkness about us, the doubt and guilt which accumulates while giving of ourselves, clouds and shades our self-confidence. We become lost in value judgments and can lose sight of what or who we are in light of who or what we hope to be. When a person becomes confused, afraid, discarded through his own error and attitude by a hostile society, and lost in hoped-for acceptance, friendship, and love because of fallen or compromised standards, then some look to the confessional as a return to acceptance and established values, a redemption. "A man cannot be comfortable without his own approval," said Mark Twain in What is a Man? The clergy and body of the church provide a solid support for the beginnings of that basic renewal. Having been involved in the Mormon confessional experience for some years, I found our author's conception of the Mormon confessional very engrossing. In the words of Gilbert and Sullivan, things are seldom what they seem, and the parallels between her views of the Mormon confidentiality and how they actually work are quite a ways apart. With her emphasis placed upon the cornerstone of ethical confidentiality upon which all else rotates, the confessional is explained upon requirement as the admission of sin or deviation in religious belief and action or behavior regarded as unacceptable within the teachings of the group. While this may be inclusive in the overall concept of confession, I have found the cornerstone of the Mormon confessional to be renewal. If renewal is not the stated objective of the confessor at the confession, at the time of confession, then all becomes just counsel and advice, and confidentiality becomes courtesy extended and consideration observed. Conversely, to remain within the church, the member must be reestablished within himself or herself as worthy. Confession of our faults is a hoped-for return to innocence. And if this involves a reflection of injuries reaching beyond the confessor, then they too must be addressed, and confidentiality is not abandoned but expanded to those included in the restorative process. The renewal process has three basic participants in the Mormon faith: the confessor, the injured party or parties, and the church. All must be considered in relationship to the member's prior action and with the intent, as far as possible, of healing the injured and redressing all wrong. Giving advice does not guarantee conduct. The confessional is a manifestation forthcoming of the individual's desire for change and willingness to amend injury. This can have many ramifications. Let's take three examples. A.J. Fife said many years ago, in talking about rowing a boat, "When you let yourself go, it's always downstream." Basically, that's true with life. Consider, a young person falls into sin with loss of self-esteem. He feels he has failed to trust and fears recrimination from friends and family. He knows this step may be a compromise towards greater problems and failure. Unsure of image at home and with trepidation, he approaches his bishop to discover that all may be cleared through rededication to principles, service and continued counsel, and support for a period of time. His confidentiality is secure. If his activity has involved another, including drugs, sex, civil authority, the breaking of the law, then the bishop has the obligation to resolve the matter in the light of the young person's future and best interest. And this is where Miss Batten will, and I will probably find some moving apart. This might or might not involve parents, civil authority, another person, or another person's bishop. Confidentiality is extended but not excused. The bishop is aware that now, as far as confidentiality is concerned, that he is dealing with a very leaky bucket. Two, an old Spanish proverb states that to whom you tell your secrets, to him you resign your liberty. Consider a married couple, perhaps with children, become involved in events of a dishonest nature, perhaps jointly, but more probably alone. It may be of any consequence, but involves deceit and dishonesty of some nature and always other people. Their marriage and church acceptance is under duress and at risk. One or both contact the bishop, surrounded by all the fear and guilt that divorce, infidelity, or jail time can generate. Under the Mormon credendum of confession, the bishop's obligation is not just to hear the confession and to offer advice, but to marshal all of the resources at his disposal. In order to redeem the individual involved, this might include professional help, monetary expenditures, but always the undivided attention of the bishop. If in the beginning or at the end, one or perhaps both cannot find the basis for renewal, then it is the bishop's decision as to how to motivate the individuals and to guard the integrity of the church. Confidentiality might be shared under these circumstances, but is never surrendered. Three, no man has any considerable period can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally becoming bewildered as to which be the true. That's from the Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Consider, a member has been involved for many years in church activity. His leadership and profile has placed him in general recognition by the membership. He is venerated and viewed as a person to be emulated. His counsel and example are accepted. When this person allows himself to be compromised, he defiles not only himself but the trust placed in him, and his actions reflect not only upon himself but extend to all the limits of his influence. When this happens, he is required to withdraw his membership from the church or to defend his membership before a council and accept the consequent change. In this case, confidentiality is absolute until resolved, and then the membership might or might not be informed in the final status. Basically, the person acknowledges his faults and orders to repair by his sincerity the damage that they have done in the eyes of others. The confessional doesn't exist unless the person involved is honestly seeking to change his status, to return to innocence, and to be reaccepted by either the institutions or the individuals that reflect upon his life. There are many ethical considerations that are concerned in all of these examples. The decision of whether the ethic credo overrides the pragmatic application of restoring lives is a question that we'll discuss here the rest of the day. Thank you for your attention. We'll turn the podium over to Father Busson.
Thank you, Keith. I know more surely than a coronary surgeon what it means to hold in my hands the human heart. More than any world explorer, I know what it means to wander the innermost crevices and plumb the deepest crevasses of the human soul. I have stood in the cauldron of God and witnessed his fire yield gold from dross. I have seen the shattered ruins of the human spirit strewn before me, made whole. I have been hearing confessions for 20 years. And as any good priest will tell you, it is the single most challenging task that we face. It is also among the surest proofs that the wily God continues to care for his people. Confession isn't about telling sins. It's about forgiveness. It's about healing. It is a sacramental bear hug from God. And those privileged to enter its mystery have seen the bruised reed made whole again, the smoldering wick fanned into a flame, the prodigal son embraced by his father, and the lost sheep hefted up on the shoulders of the Good Shepherd. When I was asked to be a part of this panel, I was at first going to decline, but I accepted the invitation because I was intrigued by your topic, and I wanted to be present as you thrashed out among yourselves an appropriate Mormon response to the issues of confidentiality, confession, and communal responsibility. In sharing our experiences as Catholics with you, I do so not in the sense that ours is the norm, or the right way, or the only way. Rather, ours is a wisdom that has been honed on 2,000 years of experience in every language and culture and niche of the world. And I hope to be for you today a sounding board, a touchstone against which you might measure what's appropriate for you as a church. Mr. Holman and Mr. Ferguson will present the legal issues. I'm going to provide the ecclesial context from which our Catholic viewpoint emerges. One way to think of the Catholic Church is, and its doctrines is to think of a teepee of our Native American brothers and sisters. As you imagine a large teepee, in your mind's eye, think for a moment of the lodge poles that form the skeleton of the structure and make it stand. Scientists would call them vectors. There are hundreds of lodge poles that stand together to make the encompassing church we call Catholic. And I'm going to explore with you just two. The forgiveness pole and the priest-people relationship pole. On the forgiveness pole or vector, there is a wide spectrum of experiences we know as a Catholic people that unveil for us the forgiving God. Simplest of all is when we approach our God in prayer as sinners. We also know forgiveness when we approach our brother or our sister whom we have wronged and we seek forgiveness. We gather ritually at every Mass and begin by publicly confessing that we are a sinful people. And then there's a sacramental form of forgiveness we call communal, in which we ritually acknowledge together our sin and together receive absolution. And finally, there is auricular confession, sacramental confession, by an individual sinner before a priest in the intimacy of the confessional. Each moment on the spectrum of this lodgepole is valid, and each is intimately tied to the other, and none can be understood in an absence of the total. Now, there is the priest-people relationship poll and its confidentiality index. A wise priest knows his people in many ways. Each knowing involves a different measure of confidentiality. There is the gut knowing that the spiritually intuitive priest has that can find in an instant the one person in a church of quiet worshipers who desperately needs his listening ear and his time. A good pastor is a community leader. He has his finger on the pulse of his people, and he hears and heeds everything from a myriad of sources. A good priest is a friend, and his parishioners count his presence among them as a blessing, and they share with him hospitality and leisure. A priest is often a confidant, a person of trust with whom we can talk about our feelings and our doubts and our yearnings. A priest may become a counselor, guiding troubled hearts, working with other professionals in crisis moments, whether they be physicians or lawyers or therapists or social workers. And finally, a priest is God's vicar. He stands with the sinner or saint who know the awesome terror of being held in the hands of the living God. The two poles converge in the arena of the confessional, and it is in this arena alone that a very special measure of confidentiality enjoys broad legal protection. The confessional seal is distinct, and it applies only to this very special arena. It is worth noting, however, that the range of knowing of a priest is far broader, and hence the degrees of confidentiality that he has with his people are more varied than of other professionals who enjoy some measure of protection and client privileges. The wise priest must be able to recognize these degrees of confidentiality and their parameters. However, with regard to the confessional seal, there is no ambiguity. This very special arena is carefully defined. It occurs generally in very special places, at designated times, by specifically ordained people using a definitive rite. There is no doubt, either on the part of the person confessing or of the confessor, as to whether we are in this special arena or not. To enter into the hands of the living God, the sinner must have absolute trust and be utterly vulnerable. He yields all control. So it is that the Church insists irrevocably and without exception that the confidentiality of that person must be protected. To provide loopholes, exceptions, or limits is to impose barriers on the broken heart craving wholeness. The confessional arena is the soul's garbage dump. Buried within its confines is sin. And sin, with its rippling effect, holds horrors so vast and wrongs so great that it makes the nuclear half-life of atomic destruction seem but an instant. It is no wonder that its protections are absolute.
Gilbert K. Chesterton, who was a literary critic and writer of detective fiction in Great Britain, was a contemporary of Arthur Conan Doyle. Chesterton created a detective by the name of Father Brown as a foil to Sherlock Holmes. Whereas Holmes solved his mysteries through observation and deductive reasoning, which when solved seemed childishly easy, Father Brown, who was also a Catholic priest, relied on history, sociology, psychology, and yes, wisdom, to find the culprit. In one very memorable story, Father Brown was investigating a crime and told one of the suspects that he was very close to ascertaining the true facts. Later, this suspect asked to see Father Brown to discuss another matter. Upon his arrival, the young suspect asked the Catholic priest if he would hear his confession, which Father Brown agreed to do. When the young penitent began to confess to having committed the crime that Father Brown was investigating, the priest knocked the young man down, covered his ears, and ran from the room. When asked by one of his colleagues why he had acted in such an unorthodox manner, Father Brown explained that the young man thought like a Catholic because he knew that if he confessed to the priest, that the priest would be oath-bound not to repeat it to anyone, and that it would have been impossible for Father Brown to continue his investigation. What is interesting about the story of Father Brown is that both priest and penitent knew exactly what the rules of engagement were. There was no question in either of their minds. Both had expectations of what proper conduct would be on the part of both of them in the event of a confession. And as the Father has told us this morning, there is no doubt and no confusion. As Professor Batten has demonstrated in her excellent work, such expectations and understandings do not exist in the relationship between clergy and parishioner in all religious congregations. A particularly astute sociologist from the London School of Economics has shown that this is particularly true with new religious movements, which have not fully developed their religious dogmas and have no tradition. An unpleasant situation, quoting from her, an unpleasant situation that can lead to a group's having a hold over an individual may arise when it has collected intimate details about their members' lives before they join the movement, or has subsequently involved them in practices of which they are likely to feel ashamed if others were to learn about them. There are movements which ask members to write down a list of their previous sins, on the understanding that the exercise is merely a means of putting the past behind them, so that, purified, they may move to a new phase in their lives. The members may be told that their confessions will be ritually destroyed, or at least that they will be treated as utterly confidential. But it has not infrequently happened that the confessions have been used at a later date for either implicit or explicit blackmail. End of quote. Professor Batten has provided a number of examples from the United States and also from Europe, which support Dr. Barker's thesis developed in Europe. I was particularly impressed by the case that she discussed, which occurred in Oklahoma and was later looked at by the Supreme Court of that state. The case, which has been referenced earlier, involves Marion Gwynn, who is a single mother who had children, who moved to a small community in Oklahoma in 1974, lived with her sister, became acquainted with the church elders of the Church of Christ, joined the church, later quit attending for a variety of reasons, which included her job, which required her to work on Sunday, and also some disaffection from the church. And what later became an important element of the lawsuit that was filed by her was the fact that even though she stopped attending the church, she did not request to be either taken off the rolls or to be excommunicated. In 1980, long after she had essentially disassociated herself from the church by not attending services, she was confronted by elders of the church with a rumor of having had a relationship with a male non-member. She admitted the relationship, and the elders, as a result, requested that, one, she stop having the relationship, which she did, and that she confess to the congregation, which she refused to do. The elders sent letters to her stating that if she did not repent, i.e., confess to the congregation, that they would withdraw fellowship from her. Now, obviously, someone put in that situation does what even the best of us try to discourage people from doing, that is, she went and saw a lawyer. And the lawyer looked at the case and sent a letter to the elders, telling them that they had better not expose her client's private life to the congregation. One day later, Gwen herself informed the elders of the church that if she had not done so previously, that she was withdrawing all fellowship from the church. The elder's response was, "Possible, no can do. You cannot unilaterally withdraw from a congregation. The congregation has to withdraw its fellowship from you." And so she essentially refused to have anything further to do, although she did have further conversations with the church elders, telling them that she would object to any information that they gave to their congregation with respect to her private life. Eventually, the elders, upon not receiving what they wanted from Ms. Gwen, reported to their congregation a series of scriptures relating to fornication, which were read from the pulpit and which, according to one of the elders, was intended to brand her as a fornicator. Following these events, Gwen not only retained a lawyer, but she filed a lawsuit claiming an invasion of privacy and also intentional infliction of emotional distress, which went to trial. And the jury trial awarded her $205,000 in actual damages and $185,000 in punitive damages. That was appealed by the church to the Oklahoma Supreme Court, which reversed and remanded. And it's the Supreme Court decision that I find particularly interesting in the context of the discussion we're having today, inasmuch as I think it shows that the area that we're discussing today is extremely more complicated than just whether or not a priest or a pastor or a bishop should or should not communicate information that he receives from a confession. Because of the fact of our tradition of religion in this country and the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution. The Oklahoma Supreme Court basically said that a situation like this is really a balancing test between whether or not a state can intervene in a religious exercise versus the privacy rights which are claimed to have been violated by the individual in question here, the young lady who filed the lawsuit. What's interesting is many of the cases that are cited by the court are cases that we're all familiar with and that are batted back and forth. They cite the Reynolds decision, for example, the polygamy decision, for the standard upon which a state can get involved in religious practices. And the current standard is that the state, and in this case was the court, can only get involved if the church action is such a threat of public safety, peace, or order that the state is justified in involving itself in pursuing a compelling interest, and in this case it would be in protecting a person's right of privacy. What's interesting about this is because it's kind of a reversal. As we all know, historically, people came to the United States to get away from situations in which churches, state-controlled churches, were controlling the very events and intimate details of their lives. And so one of the important principles upon which our Constitution was founded was to provide a separation of church and state so that the state could no longer dictate to a church or congregation what they could or could not do. What's interesting is here we are now in a lawsuit in which an individual is asking the state to intervene and to tell the church what it could or could not do. And that is the reason for the standard, of course. And the court essentially said that based on this standard, it had no right to get involved in this situation as long as the individual involved was a member of the congregation involved. And so it essentially reversed the trial court's decision insofar as it related to any action taken by the elders during her membership in the church organization. But then it turned around and said something else. It said, under the school prayer decisions, there's a protection of a person's right to either practice religion, and there's also a protection of a rights of an individual not to practice religion. And so the court said that notwithstanding the church elder's statement that a person cannot unilaterally withdraw from a church organization, they essentially have to be thrown out, according to the elders in this case, that a person had an absolute right to withdraw from a church organization at any time that they wanted unilaterally. And so the court indicated that a person would have a right to seek redress in a court of law for any actions taken by the church after her withdrawal from the church, because at that point it doesn't become an internal church parishioner relationship, but rather becomes a relationship between a former parishioner and the church in which he was formerly a member. They indicated that she had effectively withdrawn when she gave verbal notice of her intent no longer to be a member of the organization. Therefore, the court remanded back to the trial court for a reassessment of damages, and I wasn't able to determine what happened on the remand, but I asked Professor Batten this morning, and she indicated that they had reassessed damages. In what amount, I'm not sure, but in looking at the Supreme Court decision, it looks like all of the damages occurred after she had effectively withdrawn from the organization, so I would assume that they were a large number of damages. Given this case, again, rather than sit up here and pontificate about the constitutional law and what the various interests are in protecting a religious organization versus protecting a person's right to privacy, you can tell, and given your background, I'm sure would know that this is an enormously complicated area. All we have to do is think about the Reynolds decision and the arguments that were used in that decision. And, of course, the LDS Church was arguing that the state didn't have a right to interfere in its practice of plural marriage for the very reason that was utilized by this court, that is, that the Establishment Clause prevented them from doing so. Same arguments are used in the school prayer decisions, and I assume that the same types of arguments have been used and will be used in these types of cases that we're discussing today. I'd further like to point out that the cases that come from Europe need to be looked at in a little bit different light, because in Europe, particularly in Southern Europe, there is no tradition of religious freedom. And even though other churches are allowed to practice and to maintain churches and to maintain congregation, tax-exempt status, ability to own property, ability to recognize marriages performed by those clergy may or may not be recognized depending on the country in which you're talking about. So I go back then in conclusion to Professor Barker's statement that we're talking about a very difficult area. And perhaps one thought that may come out from our discussion is that individuals who align themselves with any religious organization should be entitled to know at least what the standards are in the event that confession takes place. And one thing I was struck by this morning, not really being familiar what the standards are for excommunication or confessions in the LDS tradition, is that apparently there are no strict standards which would govern all situations, which would in turn lead to situations in which perhaps a penitent would not be aware of what could occur in the event he or she confesses to his or her ecclesiastical authorities. Let me just finish up by quoting from Professor Barker's book and then leaving it at that. Individuals would be well advised to consider very carefully just how far they can trust members of a movement. And she's referring to new religious movements, but this is obviously, I think, applies to many religious groups, with the exception of the Catholic Church, which I think has a very refined tradition in this respect. Not to misuse information that they are asked to reveal, either in writing or in a counseling session. They should also consider seriously the extent to which they are prepared to indulge in, for example, sexual or illegal practices that they would not want other people to find out about. And of course, they should remember that they themselves are responsible for any practices in which they take part, whoever it was who made the suggestion or issued the command. Thank you.
When you take evidence in law school, one of the things you're taught are privileges, and one of the ones we memorized was the priest penitent privilege. And it's easy to remember, but maybe not so easy to apply. I'm representing Karen Worthington in two of the lawsuits that are filed against her. And as a result of that representation, I have briefed and argued this issue in state court. Originally, under English common law, there was no privilege for religious confessions, at least after the Reformation. And American common law comes from the English common law. So in American common law, there is no privilege either. It wasn't until... Yes? Oh. She's the wife of Richard Worthington, and Richard Worthington is the one who took over Alta View Hospital. Okay. I'm used to walking around. Her husband lay siege to Alta View Hospital and took hostages there. And as a result of that, a woman by the name of Carla Roth was shot and killed. Why was she sued? She was sued by relatives of the deceased nurse and two other patients. They allege that she knew what her husband was going to do and that she should have called the hospital, a physician in the hospital, and the police in the time between her husband left the house and before he got to the hospital. In that time period, Karen Worthington spoke to her bishop, and she spoke to her bishop ongoing throughout the marriage. And the plaintiff's attorney in the Roth-Worthington case wanted to take the deposition of the bishop, and he also wanted copies of the bishop's journal. And so I filed a motion with the court seeking to protect all of that information under the priest-penitent privilege, saying that it was not discoverable. Well, that's when I found out about the privilege. Okay, so Utah did not recognize this privilege until a statute was adopted by the territorial legislature in 1876. And that statute read, in part, that a person cannot be examined as a witness in the following case. A clergyman or priest cannot, without the consent of the person making the confession, be examined as to any confessions made to him in his professional character in the course of discipline enjoined by the church to which he belongs. It was a privilege that prevented the cleric from talking about confession so long as the member said, don't talk about it. Now, in the 114 years since the adoption of that statute, there were no published decisions on it. And that's rather remarkable. The first published decision was in December of 1990 in a case called Scott versus Haddock, or Haddow, and it was a decision from a magistrate in U.S. federal court in Salt Lake City. And the facts in that case were a father was sexually abusing one of his daughters, or was accused of sexually abusing one of his daughters. The daughter, upon attaining her majority, hired an attorney and sued her father, saying, "You sexually molested me when I was living at home." And it's one of those things where, who do you believe? They're often difficult cases to prove. So her attorney knew that her father had been excommunicated from the LDS Church. And he suspected that he had been excommunicated as a result of this conduct that he was being accused of. So the attorney, who's something of a rebel, served a subpoena on that ward, and I think it was the Corporation for the Presiding Bishopric, something like that. He served two subpoenas to get the excommunication proceeding records, the ecclesiastical court records. There was a disciplinary court held, and the father was excommunicated. So he wanted copies of all of those records. and the church refused to produce them. The church went down and argued, this falls within the confessional privilege. And the father admitted in his deposition, I never confessed. And you can't tell from the case whether or not the father ever admitted to the bishop and his counselors that he had ever molested his daughter. So you don't have a true confessional. So the attorney representing the daughter argued, there's not a confession here, therefore I'm entitled to all of these records. The best evidence we have is that the information contained in those records was provided by other members of the ward and the bishop and the counselors. None of it came from the member, from the father. So the privilege didn't apply, and only the father had the right to raise the privilege. Well, the church came in, intervened in the case, and argued, first, we have our own privilege under the First Amendment. We have our own First Amendment rights. And the judge said, I'm not getting to that. I'm not going to say whether or not churches have those constitutional rights. The majority of cases that talk about this type of privilege, written in this language, confessional privilege, have found that it's limited to a confession by the member. So those cases would have held that the church court proceedings were available. They couldn't be protected under the confidentiality of the priest-penitent privilege. Well, the magistrate didn't agree with those cases. He's a very bright magistrate. He found instead that I want to read this. He found that the Utah privilege statute protected communications made to a clergy person in his or her spiritual and professional capacity and with a reasonable expectation of confidentiality. So he expanded this privilege so that it covered the church proceedings. Now that case is on appeal to the Utah Supreme Court, and Utah Supreme Court hasn't ruled. I was relying on that case when I was defending Karen Worthington and attempting to keep her discussions with her bishop confidential, and it fits like a glove with that description of the privilege. And my case was being heard by Judge Kenneth Rigtrip, who's also a very understanding, caring judge, and he's an active member of the LDS Church. So it was an interesting day when we went down to court, argued this, and he added a lot of his views, and I wish I had the transcript here to read to you, on this issue, based on his own experience. And I don't know if he's been a bishop, I don't know if he's been a counselor, I don't know what his positions have been, but he was adding from his experience, and he thought that the privilege was overbroad. So he limited the privilege. He limited the privilege to communications that Karen Worthington made to her bishop to the extent that they constituted actual confessions, penitential communications, or matters of worthiness or compliance with LDS Church tenets. Pardon me?
Is this an instruction to the jury?
No. This is to the plaintiff's attorney. He's telling the plaintiff's attorney, you can ask the bishop questions that fall outside of this privilege.
It's on a motion.
It's on a motion. Yeah. The plaintiff's attorney's note. This is his ruling on the motion. I filed a motion for protective order to limit Karen's deposition or restrict him from getting into this area in Karen's deposition. I said, anything she told her bishop at any time, the plaintiff's attorney can't ask about. And the judge said, no. He said, he can ask her about anything except these, confidential or confessional communications, penitential communications, or matters of worthiness or compliance with LDS Church tenets. And that's the way the deposition was then taken of Karen. The plaintiff's attorney was able to ask a lot of questions of her communications with her bishop that didn't fall within there. And then the plaintiff's attorney noticed up the bishop's deposition, and then the church's law firm got involved, and they didn't get it. They got the same result, and so the bishop was deposed. That my case may or may not go to trial. And let me go a little further on this privilege. in February of this year, the Utah Supreme Court changed the rules on privilege. And they changed the rules with respect to the priest penitent privilege. They adopted a new rule. And this rule was in effect in April of 92. And this new rule says, it defines cleric, it defines communication. A communication is confidential if made privately and not intended for further disclosure except to other persons present in furtherance of the purpose of the communication. And then it says, general rule of privilege. A person has a privilege to refuse to disclose and to prevent another from disclosing any confidential communication to a cleric in the cleric's religious capacity and necessary and proper to enable the cleric to discharge the functions of the cleric's office according to the usual course of practice or discipline. So now the Utah Supreme Court has broadened the privilege, so just about anything that a member tells to his bishop that has to do with his standing in the church, and there's nobody else present, or the people who are present have got a right to be there, is going to be privileged. Now, here's where the problem arises, as I see it, and I'm not talking about Karen Worthington's case now at all. And this is one of the things that Judge Rigtrip said when he made his ruling, is it says there are cases of child abuse, neglect, and those type of things that go unreported because of confidentiality. The earlier statute, when it's just a confessional statute, you have the person who may have done the act is a past act making the confession. Maybe under those circumstances, I would suspect there's usually not a threat to third persons in the future. Okay? Now, under this new definition of the privilege, any confidential communication to a cleric in the cleric's religious capacity and necessary and proper to enable the cleric to discharge his functions, if somebody comes in and says, you know, I need your help, I'm planning on doing this in the future, the privilege prevents the cleric from disclosing it. It also, because it's not a confessional privilege, if someone comes in and says, this member of our church is sexually abusing his daughter, this privilege applies. Under the confessional, there's not a confession there. This is just information that's been provided to the cleric that he can do with as he pleases. But under this new statute, I think that what it means is somebody comes in with information that the crime's being committed out here, somebody's being hurt, the privilege applies, and the cleric can't disclose that information. Now, that seems to be at odds with the Utah Child Abuse Reporting Act. And the reason I'm talking about this is because this child abuse and sexual molestation seems to be the area where this privilege creates problems. The Child Abuse Reporting Act that was adopted in 1988 requires people to notify the authorities if they know of or have reason to suspect that child abuse is occurring. I'm paraphrasing. Now, there's an exception for the clergy. It says the notification requirements of this section do not apply to clergymen without the consent of the person making the confession with regard to any confession made to him in his professional character in the course of discipline enjoined by the church to which he belongs if the confession was made directly to the clergyman by the perpetrator and the clergyman is under canon law or church doctrine or practice bound to maintain the confidentiality of that confession. That limits the exemption for the clergy to a true confessional by the perpetrator. It goes on to say, if a clergyman or priest receives information about abuse or neglect from any source other than the confession of the perpetrator, he is required to give notification on the basis of that information, even though he may have also received a report of abuse or neglect from the confession of the perpetrator. Now, I don't know what this sentence means. Exemption of notification requirements for a clergyman or priest does not exempt a clergyman or priest from any other efforts required by law to prevent further abuse or neglect of the perpetrator. I don't know what that means. But you can see it's a difficult issue. Even the legislature doesn't really know what to do with it. I think what the legislature's done, though, is they've restricted the privilege to the true confession. So if a bishop hears, say the wife comes in and I suspect that my husband's abusing our daughter, sexually abusing our daughter. Under this statute, the bishop has to tell the authorities because the information's not coming from the perpetrator and it's suspected child abuse. Thank you. That may be true. It may be that in subsequent proceedings, the reporting of the child abuse will also be privileged.
Thanks very much. I see there's a great deal of interest in questions, so I will make my remarks extremely brief. After all, you can always go out and read the book, and there's no reason why I should give away the plot. I did want, though, to make some remarks about a panel that, although perhaps informally organized, I think has actually had quite an interesting structure and impact by starting with the root religious perceptions to begin with and their distinct differences, and then moving to the kinds of problems that these different perceptions produce in actual practice. Is that better? That's better. Just to make sure that you haven't missed anything, let me ask you just a couple of questions. One is about awareness of what the policies of a religious group of which you might be a member are. How many people in this room know exhaustively what the policies with regard to confessional material are of the group of which you're a member? I'm not asking you what group it is. I want to know how many people are certain of what those policies are. Yeah. This is an astonishing fact. Right? It's not a surprise, but it's of the facts that seem to me to be relevant, perhaps the most conspicuous one. Okay. We're then in this panel, although this book considers some other situations, have been discussing primarily two policies. One, the Catholic policy, which stresses the importance of making possible complete and fully open confession, and in order to make that possible, insists on absolute confidentiality in this specific situation. And on the other hand, the LDS policy, which also emphasizes renewal and reform, but allows release of confidentiality in a number of situations. You've talked, Mr. Frogley, about expanding confidentiality. It might be claimed that that's a sort of double speak, right? To expand confidentiality is to give up on it as soon as you tell somebody else or let somebody else in on the secret. True confidentiality is gone. Now, I don't want to try to decide here between these two policies. That's actually not the point. The point is to see, however, that these are policies, all of which are open to kinds of ethical critique. How many people know what the we've just been told, so this question's a little bit out of date. It's going to ask you about legal policies concerning any confidential, any confessional revelation you might make within a church group. Now we know. How many knew before you heard the interesting talks from this lawyer? For sure? Complete? Exhaustively? Right. So what was said was no surprise? It's... Well, we all live... Well, all right. I forgot that people live in various places. But of the jurisdiction in which you live, how many knew exhaustively? Right. About as many as before. These matters, however, are not trivial. And the fact that we as inhabitants of a particular region don't know, we don't know about our churches, and we don't know about the legal requirements imposed on our churches, that fact is also extraordinary. One comment I'd like to make, and I really do intend to go on to questions, though it has to do with the evolution of these policies. Now, Catholic tradition has remained stable since, I believe, the time of the Council of Trent. This policy of absolute confidentiality was formulated at that time, and although there are occasional pickings at it, as with the Bartsch case, the young boy in Germany, from time to time, that policy has remained unchanged. In the LDS Church, however, as I have watched it over a number of years, it seems to me that what is occurring there is a kind of evolution away from church policies in which many kinds of infractions were routinely divulged, often after the result of a court trial, and the nature of the conclusion of the court and the content of the infraction was routinely made public to the entire group. Mormon policy seems to be evolving to me in the direction of becoming more Catholic-like. Right? If you look at the repeated assertions in the bishop's handbook, there are repeated assertions of the importance of confidentiality, new assertions that a member's own confessional material cannot be brought before a court without that member's consent. Those things are new within the last couple of years. The next question, of course, is that the direction that you really want to evolve in? Right? You had said something, Father, about wanting to be here as members of the Mormon Church discussed the appropriate Mormon response. I think this is an issue up for discussion among Mormons, and it does well to reflect on whether you want to wanted to evolve in the direction of the Catholic Church or perhaps in the direction of the church in which Marion Gwynne was, in effect, obliged to, or her confession was made a matter of essentially public knowledge. It doesn't have to go in one direction or another. What's essential, though, and especially essential in listening to remarks made by the father here, is to get some sense of what's at stake in adopting one policy of confessional confidentiality or another. I would, I think questions, however, are important. So rather than discuss further what the point of critiquing religious practices and beliefs is in this way, I think it's important to go on that. To that. One last note, though, about critique. Right? Sometimes said, well, look, we can't critique religious practices with professional or any other ethics. Right? This is a different realm. It's immune to that kind of critique. This really is another world, and so secularly based critique, or the kind of critique that professional ethicists, of which I am one, has no hold. But remember this, right? We're in the habit of praising religious groups from time to time for their courage or fidelity or strength or contribution to human intimacy and welfare. Praise is a type of ethical critique. It's the positive form. You can't do praise unless you're also willing to leave open the possibility of negative critique. So the general message here is, if there is to be any possibility of admiring the contributions of religious groups, with that comes the possibility of taking more negative and critical views as well. So have it both ways. Either say nothing at all about religious groups, or consider that ethical critique is must go across the board. Thanks. You want to do questions?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you've got as many ideas running through your mind as I have, I guess it's time. Let's start right here and go around. This lady.
The question, I believe, is referring to the case in Germany of the young man who confessed to the priest that he had murdered and then could the priest hear his cry for help and do something to prevent him from doing it again? I appreciate the question. First of all, and I really appreciated, Mike, your beginning with Father Brown's story. You all know, you know, Jessica goes out as a writer, and she solves mysteries, or Quincy, and as a physician, is able to solve mysteries using medical science, or the rabbi comes on Friday, can use the Talmud to solve mysteries. Each of those professionals have what I would call an arsenal of skills that they can bring to bear to make things better, whether it be medicine or journalism or what have you. The priest also has a very powerful arsenal in the confessional. And the purpose of the confessional is for healing, not to solve crime or prevent crime. So remember that. And that it can also, as a side, perhaps do that is wonderful, but that's not its primary purpose. Now, if you undermine the arsenal, if you take away all of the tools of the priest, then don't blame him for being able to stop crime. And essential to the arsenal is confidentiality of the seal. Because if there weren't confidentiality, there's no way that kid would have walked in the door. The only way the priest is able to even offer any help, and that's a particularly interesting case, because he tried. He did everything in his power to help that person using the skills and tools at hand. But to criticize him, to say, well, he didn't stop the crime, is unfair. That wasn't what he was trying to do. Okay? And if you had asked him to stop the crime, you would have destroyed the arsenal. The issue with confidentiality, and Dr. Batten makes this very clear, is you either have it or you don't. You can't have it both ways. And if you expect people to be trusting and vulnerable before you or before their God, to be absolutely sure they understand that it's confidential. If they don't think it's confidential, they're not going to talk to you. So in this case, you condemn the priest because he had the form to do his best. Then you take away the form and say he shouldn't have done it. Well, he wouldn't have had the situation. So I really firmly believe that it was precisely because he had the tool of confidentiality in his arsenal that he was able to even do what he did. But if you had taken that away, he could have done nothing because he would never have had the situation.
Thank you. We've got about 15 minutes left, and there's a lot of questions, so why don't we try to keep them brief and go. Margaret? In which faith? Are you talking about LDS or in Catholicism? Does it ever go to where you'd give it to the Monsignor Father or to a bishop? In fact,
in the context of confessional, it can be told to no one.
In the LDS Church, it's not specifically laid out in every aspect, but generally it deals with first if in talking to the confessor. If it comes to the point where it needs to be expanded to include a husband, if it's a wife, or another person's, or a boss, or money stolen, all of these type of things, then it's usually asked, with your permission, may we extend this? No, that doesn't usually happen unless it... Yeah, this. But before that goes to that, the bishop will, and believe me, we've got enough bishops and that aren't trained enough that this thing falls apart as far as each individual, how he might approach it. But the basic delineation or razor's edge is that when the person commends in the confessor and it is expanded beyond himself, if it's something that he has a sin of eating too much, or he's been lusting after somebody, but it's as far as it's gone, then it stops there. But if it goes to the point where it involves other areas of injury, then the bishop says to the confessor, you either have the obligation at this time to withdraw your membership or give me permission to make the corrections necessary to reestablish you within the faith. That's the watershed. And if he says, well, I'll withdraw, then the confidentiality is kept. And I can give you several examples where that's happened, of people that have left marriages and left the church and have had felonies done that haven't been reported, and they've left the church. But when they have decided that they wanted to renew their innocence and their acceptance within the community of the Mormon faith, then they give their consent to expand that to other authorities and to individuals in their family. Oh yeah, it's there's no, you can't expand confidentiality, and I knew that I was going to get that. But I didn't say excommunicated. No, you don't have to do that. You say I want to work this out in. Yeah, but if you're going to work it out, then how can you have somebody come in and want to be reestablished in the Mormon church if he's an adulterer and he still wants to stay with his wife and family? And you know it, and he has offices within the ward. You say, first of all, you're going to give up the offices within the ward, and you're going to have to work it out with your wife. And if you're not willing to do that, then I can't help you. Because there is no place within the church for the adulterer. There is forgiveness within the church, and there is repentance within the church, and there is a way within the church. But if the adulterer is unrepentant within the church, then the community usually rejects. Not necessarily. Yeah, but let me just give you an example that I'm aware of. I know of a man who had abused his children for 10 years and had not been... He came to church, but he held no office, and no one knew of his involvement. And for years, he remained within the church. His family was in the church, and the children were there. And the bishop knew of what was happening. After 10 years, he came and wanted to have that resolved. And then he met with the state president and took the steps. And he has been reinstated within the church, and that's been resolved. But the Well, the bishop talked to the wife about the family, not specifically that he knew what the husband was doing, and asked what might be done. And the children, it was a can of worms. It really is. But those are things that have been done. Now, it's easy to say that you can waste someone for the rights of the others, like the boy that confessed in the Catholic thing. And yet three other young boys died because that wasn't revealed. You can take all kinds of what ifs. What if somebody's going to shoot the Pope and he's confessed it to a priest that I'm going to, you know, or the bishop and it's a or the president or something like that, where thousands of people are going to be. Then it seems trivial. But there is a razor's edge of the principle that's involved. And you're always going to get these wide swings of shades of gray in struggling and searching for the black and white. Excuse me, I didn't mean to take that much time. Question here.